This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole. Hundreds of high school students gathered this week in the wake of the school shooting in Parkland, Florida. They're calling for tougher gun control measures.
Tell me what democracy looks like!
This is what democracy looks like!
We hear from students and parents at a huge walkout in Fort Collins. Also this week, arts reporter Stacy Nick brings us to a mystery behind a new exhibition at Colorado State University.
We began to feel really strange not knowing who this was. After all, 1,107 times we looked at her name, Florence, and wondered, who did this? Why? Where?
We'll find out more about this unique exhibit and who exactly Florence was. We also look at the future of Interstate 25 and what could be a long trip from Fort Collins to Denver if nothing changes. And we'll hear from our film critic, Howie Mofshevitz, who reviews the Russian film Loveless. But first, to the debate over guns. It's not just an issue for schools. As KUNC's Benta Berkland reports from the state capitol, guns and security inside that building full of lawmaking and lobbying is an ongoing concern. She even discovered that some lawmakers bring their guns to work.
Colorado's capital is known for its gold dome. The granite building sits in the heart of Denver, overlooking the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. And like 28 other capital buildings across the country, the public can't just walk into the chambers off the street. The building has two metal detectors that lobbyists and other members of the public must pass through. For the first time this year, officers at the checkpoints are requiring people to remove belts.
It's easier to get on an airplane than it is to get into the people's capital.
That's longtime lobbyist Mike Beasley. He's backing a bill that would create a TSA pre-check type system for people to bypass security after getting a background check. It's already been done in a handful of other states. Most lobbyists come in and out of the Capitol 5 to 10 times each day. Combined with school groups and tourists, there are backlogs.
We're out of balance in terms of security requirements and public safety.
Colorado didn't used to have any security checkpoints. That changed in 2007 when an armed man was shot and killed inside the Capitol after he threatened the governor at the time. Lawmakers and other employees can still avoid the metal detectors by entering through other locked doors with a state-issued card. But it doesn't make Democratic Representative Faith Winter feel secure.
We have seen an increase in mass shootings, both at schools and public places. When we're on the floor with the balconies, we're sitting targets. This session is especially tense. It's an election year, so it's hyperpartisan. There's a lot of sexual harassment claims.
Winter was the first person to come forward publicly to KUNC and then file a formal complaint against a fellow Democratic House member. He may soon face an expulsion vote. Three Republican senators have also been investigated for sexual harassment. There are 8 investigations in total. For Democratic Representative Alec Garnett, that's reason enough not to change how people enter the building.
In this moment, it's kind of a perfect storm of a cultural shift, a lot of tension, and then lobbyists pushing a bill to decrease security. And that doesn't make any sense to me.
He says adding to his stress is the fact that lawmakers can carry concealed weapons because of a state law that designates the Capitol as their place of business. But for others, that's a comfort. They say gun-free zones are dangerous. Republican Representative Lori Sain says she regularly carries a concealed gun.
I feel very secure here, and of course a lot of our members on our side in the caucus carry, so I'm very comfortable. You know, I'm very comfortable in my leadership meeting, by the way, because everybody's armed there.
Sain herself was at the center of a debate over Second Amendment rights when she was arrested in December at a security checkpoint at Denver International Airport with a loaded gun.
I'm like thousands of people across the U.S. that grabbed the wrong bag, and that's what happened. The weapon was never outside my area of control, other than when I put it into the scanner. So the important thing is you do need to keep the weapon under your control at all times.
And that hasn't always happened inside the Capitol. 4 years ago, a different state lawmaker accidentally left his gun in a committee room. Democratic Representative Jonathan Singer found the gun when he was cleaning up after a hearing and says that incident is one reason he doesn't want lawmakers to carry guns.
When you enter a government building, when there are heated, vigorous debates and people are on edge, sleep deprived, and, you know, let's be honest, there are people in this building who are drinking. That is a deadly mix.
The gun policy debate is notoriously heated in the state. Democrats passed stricter gun laws after the Aurora Theater shooting in 2012, and it led to the successful recall of two lawmakers. Meanwhile, the Colorado State Patrol has ramped up security in the wake of sexual harassment allegations after a group of legislative aides and interns wrote a letter saying they didn't feel safe. Some lawmakers have also increased their own personal security.
That's Benta Berkland. And to update the sexual harassment angle, this week, for the first time in more than a century, a Colorado lawmaker may be expelled from the legislature. Now, that's after allegations of sexual harassment against Representative Steve Lebsack were found to be credible. A vote is expected Friday. You can follow that story by the minute at KUNC.org. As for guns, it seems everyone has something to say about them lately, and that includes students who are walking out of classrooms around the country to demand a safe place to learn. Many are asking for tougher gun control in response to the Valentine's Day shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, that left 17 dead. When hundreds of students in Fort Collins took to the streets earlier this week, KUNC's Stephanie Daniel was there.
Show me what democracy looks like!
This is what democracy looks like!
Show me what democracy looks like!
The planned walkout was originated by students at Pruder High School last week. But as word quickly spread through social media, students from other middle and high schools expressed their desire to join. Alexandra Holton is a 16-year-old junior and one of the organizers.
As high school students, you know, we should not be afraid to get an education. That is not fair. Beyond that, you know, there have been shootings at concerts, movie theaters, in all of the places that we as high school students go to hang out, to develop, to be kids, is taking over by gun violence, and that is something that we are going to end today.
While other schools around the country have frowned on student walkouts, Pruder principal Kathy McKay supported it. But she left it up to the parents to excuse their children from school.
We support students, regardless of their perspective, exercising their rights and being a part of the community.
Many of the walkout organizers wore black t-shirts with the hashtag Never Again on the front. 16-year-old Eliana Pritchett goes to Pruder. She says there's a lot more they want to do to curb gun violence.
We want to encourage people to call their representatives and express their opinions. We want to encourage people, like, this isn't a one-time thing. This isn't we march, we rally, and then this goes away. This is we will not stop protesting until we see a change in legislation as in regards to gun laws.
Hundreds of students joined them to march from near Pruder High School to Old Town Fort Collins. They were joined by parents and members of the community. Many carried signs saying enough is enough and lives over bribes.
So my sign says NRA, not the right answer. So many politicians are backed by the NRA, and the NRA shouldn't be involved in like any politics at all. It's just not okay.
Jake Johnson is 16 and a junior at Pruder High School. He was joined by his twin brother, Dane.
We were all talking about this before we actually started the march, where it would be more significant if like the students were all walking together, to the extent where it's like student run, student acted, like where we've put that power into our own hands. And I think it's really important that we stand together as a family for something that that we all really believe in.
The boys were marching with their mom, Becky Jensen. She carried a sign that said assault rifles are overkill on one side, and on the other it said fund mental health.
The best thing I could hope for my boys is that they're happy and kind human beings. And so when I see them becoming these amazing young adults who are standing up for what they believe in, it just, my heart is just so full today.
During the nearly 3-mile walk, counter-protesters drove by the marchers. They gunned their engines to blow exhaust fumes, something known as coal rolling. One white pickup truck carried both the American and Confederate flag. Anand, a 16-year-old junior who saw the truck, said, everyone has a right to their own opinion.
Well, I just think it's really wonderful that kids have the ability to make a difference, whether it be, you know, for guns or against guns. I just think it's important that our opinions are heard, and hopefully they'll make change.
When the marchers finally made it to Old Town, they were greeted by cheers of support. And in the crowd were Becky Jensen and her twin boys, Dane and Jake.
I just hope something will happen because of this. I am just so glad that there's this many people here. It's just awesome.
Yeah, I think we've had a successful march.
I just hope that our elected officials will take notice and make some much needed changes.
That was Stephanie Daniel. Now to cars and the cost of living. Chances are what you're spending on insurance in Colorado this year is more than last year. Prices are going up and fast. And as KUNC's Kyra Buckley reports, a new study shows Colorado is third in the nation for rising prices.
Annual auto insurance premiums have gone up 52% in Colorado since 2011. That's according to a new report from The Zebra, an insurance search engine. Vince Plymel is with the State Division of Insurance. He says more expensive vehicle parts, things like sensors and backup cameras, as well as distracted driving accidents, are all pushing up the cost of claims. And that is translating into higher premiums. But there's another big factor.
More people in Colorado, more people on the roads. And more people on the roads usually means more congestion, more accidents.
Colorado comes in just behind Montana and Mississippi, which have seen premium increases of more than 60%. Most states where costs went up had less than a 30% increase.
Well, not only are cars more expensive to drive in Colorado, there are more of them. As the state's population continues to grow, transportation officials are grappling with how best to pay for new roads and fix the old ones. One hot spot for congestion is northern Colorado, where a group of communities are taking matters into their own hands. KUNC's Matt Bloom has this story.
We're ready.
At his home in Fort Collins, Jim Volpa is getting ready to drive his daughter to Denver International Airport.
I just need to get my shoes on here.
She has a scholarship interview at the University of Montana, so making their flight is critical. But they've already had to change their travel plans. It's snowing and a semi-crash has closed Interstate 25 just north of the Highway 34 exit.
What we're going to do is we'll head down to Longmont, and then 66 will connect with I-25 out, you know, in Longmont area. Then we just have a little ways to 470. All right, we'll talk to you later. Okay.
While Volpa had a backup plan, others spent hours waiting for this 14-mile stretch of interstate between Fort Collins and the Loveland exit to reopen. These kinds of crashes and traffic jams are only going to get worse. The population around this area is expected to double to 1.3 million by 2050.
When you get this during rush hour, it is just awful.
And that's why it's going to change.
So we're adding one more lane of traffic to I-25 in both directions, from Highway 402 all the way up to 14.
Jared File is a spokesperson for the Colorado Department of Transportation. He says it will be an express lane open to carpoolers, public transit, or anyone willing to pay a fee.
If you're going Fort Collins to DIA, you can pay that extra toll so that you know that going from Fort Collins down to DIA will be exactly the time that you can predict. It's trip reliability.
CDOT doesn't have an exact start date for the $330 million project, other than sometime this year, but it is expected to be completed by 2021, and that's a lot quicker than what was proposed just a few years ago.
Because at that time, we were talking about 60, 70 years before they were saying they meaning CDOT, was going to do any improvements along our corridor. We thought that was ridiculous.
Weld County Commissioner Barbara Kirkmeyer is a member of the I-25 Coalition. This grassroots group of county and municipal leaders from Fort Collins to Thornton got together on their own.
Everybody came to the table and said, we're going to focus on our corridor and we're going to figure out how to get funding to this corridor.
After 4 years of robust discussions, here's the funding breakdown for the Express Lanes project. Fort Collins put in $19 million. Johnstown, a town of 15,000, contributed $7 million. Weld County chipped in $3 million. And when you add state funds, federal grants, and other contributions, it was enough to get it started.
It's the one project in my nearly 20 years up here that has I've seen everybody galvanize around.
Mark Jackson represents Fort Collins. He says he's seen a slow but steady shift in attitude from members of the coalition, realizing that they need to get this done now.
Where things that may have been covered by federal funds and grant sources in the past no longer are there, and so states are having to rely on partnerships and do what they can at a more regional and local level.
But this is just one project. CDOT's grand vision for the road's 50-plus mile stretch from Fort Collins to Denver is three general-purpose lanes and one express lane each way, something that's not likely to happen anytime soon, as Governor John Hickenlooper pointed out in this year's State of the State address.
Not only do we underfund maintenance by more than $200 million per year, but we also have a project list of $9 billion. Total needs are estimated to be $25 billion by 2040. And that's all on top of CDOT's existing budget.
When we get to Crossroads.
An existing budget that CDOT's Jared File says is right now relying on money from communities that are a part of the I-25 coalition.
Towns like Johnstown, what they have contributed not just for the I-25 expansion, but for the 402 expansion, they're tapped out. This is not something that is sustainable for them to be able to do.
Help could come from a Trump administration proposal to boost spending on infrastructure, but that too would require states to put up matching money. At the state capitol, efforts to fund road projects are uncertain, and there's a new movement underway to put a sales tax question for transportation in front of voters this fall.
That's Matt Bloom. Now to climate change, which appears to be hurting the ski industry. As KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle reports, one climate advocacy group says the Rocky Mountain West is especially vulnerable.
Protect Our Winters looked at data over the last 16 years. The nonprofit found that years with lots of snow created more than 2,000 extra jobs in the Mountain West. Low snow years, on the other hand, cost the region about 3,000 jobs. Tom Foley works with Intopia Business Intelligence. It's a travel technology and research company. Analysts there did their own research and came to similar conclusions. Snow is currency.
There are lodging taxes to consider. There are retail sales taxes to consider. And there is, of course, on-mountain operations to consider, which is the most directly and dramatically impacted by low snow.
Foley says ski resorts are adapting to, quote, the looming reality of less snow by doing things like hosting music festivals and weddings and summer sports like mountain biking.
During the early 1990s, a man donated several boxes to Colorado State University's Department of Design and Merchandising. In them was an unusual collection from his recently deceased aunt. At the time, the boxes were cataloged and placed in storage. And over time, the details of their arrival were lost. That is, until two volunteers unraveled the mystery. KUNC Arts reporter Stacy Nick has more.
For a lot of people, this might sound like an unusual request.
Terry and I just got assigned the hankies.
That's Marcella Wells, a volunteer with CSU's Avenir Museum of Design and Merchandising. For Wells and fellow volunteer Terry Cornell, cataloging unique articles of clothing and textiles is just part of the gig.
So for about 7 weeks, we sat as a team and accessioned every single one of them, which meant touching every one of them, taking it out of its box, opening it up, writing a written description, tagging it with a number, and then photographing it.
They did that 1,107 times. That's the total number of handkerchiefs in the collection, which spanned from the late 1930s through the 1970s. There are handkerchiefs of almost every conceivable type and for every occasion. Black ones for funerals, festive ones for holidays. There are even hankies commemorating individual states along Route 66 and the 1962 Seattle World's Fair.
They had been around and they needed to be documented more carefully and thoroughly.
That's Avenir Museum curator Katie Knowles.
And when the unpacking happened in our new facility that opened in 2016, some things sort of came to the attention of, oh, you know, we should really get this one done.
As they went through the boxes, Marcella Wells says they began to create a mental picture of just who owned these handkerchiefs.
I just envisioned a typical 1950s, 40s, 50s housewife.
Obviously, she loved handkerchiefs. She was even a member of the Hanky of the Month Club, a sort of subscription service for handkerchiefs that was popular in the 1940s and 50s. But given the number of accompanying gift cards found with them, it appears she too was well-loved.
To me, a collection like this from friends and family would have meant something really heartwarming.
The one thing they didn't have? The original owner's full name. The only clue was a monogram on many of the handkerchiefs, Florence.
When she kept meticulous records of who gave her what and when, she never kept an envelope with these cards. She kept the cards, they're lovely, but not the envelopes. It was very frustrating.
That's Terry Cornell.
We began to feel really strange not knowing who this was. After all, 1,107 times we looked at her name, Florence, and wondered, who did this? Why? Where? And finally, we got some answers.
After weeks of scouring through the collection, Cornell took one last look through the boxes. And then she saw it, a lone envelope addressed to Florence Libke.
I rushed home to my genealogical sources online and plugged her into Ancestry and Family Search, and bam, up she came.
Florence Libke was a file clerk from Chicago. The daughter of German immigrants, she had three sisters and one brother, and while she never married or had children, Florence was very loved.
My name is Pat Gilbert O'Neill. I am the grandniece of Florence Libke.
O'Neill's father, Paul Gilbert, was a professor at CSU and the mystery man who donated the collection all those years ago. But the handkerchiefs, those were a mystery to O'Neill. Although it did answer something she'd long wondered about after a visit to her aunt's studio apartment.
There were boxes and boxes and boxes of stuff. I didn't realize at the time that it was probably, a lot of it were handkerchiefs, but she said, these are my treasures.
After being contacted by the museum, O'Neill helped fill in the gaps about her Auntie Flo, a fearless career woman who loved riding roller coasters even into her 70s. She also shared photos of Florence that are now part of the Avenir exhibit, Nothing to Sneeze At, One Woman, 1,107 Hankies. Curator Katie Knoll says it's not often that single donations come with so much documentation, but then that's also pretty telling about Florence.
Well, she was a file clerk. I mean, she took her work home with her. I guess she really liked filing.
For volunteer Marcella Wells, who curated the exhibition, the show is a tribute both to the hanky and to Florence.
When I see a hanky now in a thrift store or a vintage collection, I just always spend an extra few seconds with it because it's like, okay, that meant something to someone at some point.
And that's Nothing to Sneeze At.
That was arts reporter Stacy Nick. If you're as curious as I am now to see all those hankies, the exhibit will be on display at the Avenir Museum at CSU through August. Or you can check out some photos right now at our website, kunc.org. Now to the movies. In Loveless, a new film from Russia, a couple's fighting drives their young son away from home. The film is one of the five nominees for Best Foreign Language Film in Sunday night's Oscar ceremony. KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, says Loveless paints a critical picture of Russia today.
Moscow looks good in Andrei Zvyagintsev's Loveless. The film shows elegant black-and-white shots of a woodland in winter, with snow on the tree limbs, contrasting with the wintry black of a pond. Indoors, Boris and Zhenya's apartment sports big rooms, king-size beds, a proper upper-middle-class kitchen. Big windows overlook a park. It looks like both the couple and the country are prospering. Then Zhenya and Boris start to talk. They may cohabit in this ideal space, but they're mired in end-stage divorce, and they say the kinds of things they can never take back. The depth of their mutual hatred makes you think of the fights in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, except these two aren't going through a nightly drunken ritual. In Loveless, it's straight-out, deep-seated, blame-filled fury, with not a drop of decent feeling left between them. Their 12-year-old son Alexei retreats to his bedroom, where he holds on to himself for dear life and shakes with tears. In a scene or two, he'll run away. Neither parent notices. Zhenya, Mariana Spivak, comes home late from sex with her boyfriend, slides out of her clothes, and climbs into bed. Boris, Alexei Rosin, doesn't come home at all, and they might never know that their child is missing if the school doesn't call to ask where he's been the past 3 days. The title Loveless is an understatement. There may be no love at all in this entire clean-edged, newly minted Russia, which writer-director Zviagintsev shows as a place of callous fraud and rich surfaces. Boris's boss is a hypocritical religious zealot in designer suits. The cops tell Zhenya directly that they can't afford to conduct a real search for the boy, and they brush off the business by assuring her that boys like Alexei almost always come back after a couple of chilly nights on the streets. Even after Alexei's vanished, Boris and Zhenya continue fighting. They talk about Alexei as it, and both seem to wish the boy'd never been born. Zhenya calls Alexei's birth repulsive. Zhenya's lovely mother is in the film for about 10 minutes and never stops her diatribe against her daughter and son-in-law and warns Zhenya not to drop your spawn on me. It's the picture of Russian society that has the real grab. It's neat and clean and opulent. Apartments have clean, precise lines. The grocery market's filled with goods and produce. The cars are new. The hospitals look well-run. People dress well and eat well in restaurants, and then stagger off drunk into the night. And it's not as if people have become worse with their wealth. Zhenya's mother, a figure from the Soviet period, lives in a ramshackle home, but is no less bilious than anyone else in the film. I haven't seen such furious and not subtle social criticism in a Russian movie since the Soviet work of the 1920s praised the revolution for booting out the fat capitalists, smoking equally fat cigars while their brutal Cossacks mowed down the striking workers. But Loveless is not all misery and greed. The cops tell Zhenya and Boris to contact a search and rescue organization made up of all volunteers. It's a group of dedicated men and women who know how to look for a missing kid. They're organized, expert, and selfless. They comb the fields in orderly rows. They search the apartment buildings and scan the security camera videos. They interview the missing boy's friend to find out where the kids hang out together. The searchers ask for nothing in return. They don't criticize the parents who won't put their venom aside even during the search. The rescuers just go about their work. They give a damn. Boris and Zhenya, though, would rather get on with their new lives and loves.
That was KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz. And time for one last little story about supporting the local arts. Officials with the national nonprofit Art Space say there is substantial need for more affordable housing for artists in Fort Collins. In its final report released this week, ArtSpace noted that the city could benefit from up to 90 new units, including integrated live workspaces. Peggy Lyle is with the downtown Fort Collins Creative District.
I think it's up to us, as much as that's a hard thing for us to hear, it's up to us to determine what our future is and if ArtSpace can be a part of it.
Several years ago, ArtSpace helped establish a 30-unit site in Loveland. It's also working with a state initiative to bring mixed-use sites for artists to 9 rural communities in Colorado. Thanks for joining us for Colorado Edition from KUNC. Our show was produced by news director Michael DeJuana and me. Editors Brian Larson and Ashley Jeffcoat contributed to our show. Our intro music this week was Good Grief by Ryan Little. The outro music was Big Crunch by Drake Stafford. Other music in the show came from Spinning Ratio, Long Way Home, Pipe Choir, Almost Time, and October 9 by Drake Stafford. I'm Erin O'Toole. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week for KUNC's Colorado Edition.